your hosts. I'm Diane Bortoletto.
And I'm Monique Chicardo. Let's do it.
Hello, hello, and welcome to And Away We Go, F1 Podcast, a Formula One podcast that goes beyond the track limits to talk about travel, food, and lifestyle surrounding the sport. I'm Diane Bortoletto, your pre-Drive to Survive fan, and today I'm in Perth.
And I'm Monique Chicardo, your post-Drive to Survive Formula One fan. Today I am still in Stavanger in the southwest of Norway.
And today we are joined by a very special guest, Riley Sullivan, who is a lifestyle and Formula One journalist. Hey, Riley, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And where are you at the moment?
I'm in Sydney at the moment, rainy Sydney today.
Are you a pre-Drive to Survive or post-Drive to Survive Formula One fan?
That's a good question, Di. I think I'm a little bit of both because I think just through osmosis, you know, growing up, Formula One was there. You know, we all remember, especially Lewis Hamilton and, you know, those Mercedes years. It was so like there, but I really didn't get into it, I have to say, until Drive to Survive.
Mm-hmm. The catalyst for a lot of us.
Yeah. And Drive to Survive just made me love the sport even more.
We haven't even spoken much about your career at the moment, but being a Formula One journalist, I can imagine that Drive to Survive has been just so wonderful for your own career because it has made it such a popular sport, both, you know, for sport journalism and lifestyle journalism.
I think that's so true. And honestly, opportunities to talk to the drivers, to get involved, I think it's opened up this whole universe where before it might have just been your kind of really strict sports journalists and sports outlets, your ESPNs and Sky Sports and places like that. Mm-hmm. Whereas now, you know, lifestyle magazines, all different types of media want a piece of Formula One and vice versa. The teams are really excited to have more of that kind of branding across, yeah, all different types of media.
Oh, hell yeah.
So much easier these days than what it was. Like when I was working in PR for an F1 team back in the late 90s, like 150 million years ago, like the part of the brief was to get off the sports pages and get into the lifestyle pages. It was a tough gig, I've got to say. So, well, tougher than I think it is now. I love this resurgence of Formula One.
It's so good. It is honestly so good.
All right, Riley, so tell us, how did you get into becoming a Formula One journalist?
Well, I mean, just sort of coming off that, I mean, it was very much Drive to Survive. I think, you know, during the pandemic and everything, we were all binging. I certainly was. And I thought about it, I'm like, God, this is so interesting. Not just the racing and the cars, but the politics in the paddock, right? You know,
oh, yeah.
You know, 10 teams, 20 drivers. And what I liked about it was it's so easy to kind of pick up as a sport. You know, it's not super complicated. It's not like there's hundreds of names to learn. So I thought, wow, you know, there's 20 guys on the grid. I wonder if as a journalist, I was already working as a journalist by then, but not particularly in sport. And I thought, oh, I wonder if any of the teams would be interested in doing a feature or an interview with one of their drivers. And it really started like that. And I have to really credit particularly the Haas team because they were, they're just lovely people. It's obviously a very kind of small team and very much they do a lot with a lot less, frankly, than some of the other sort of other teams. Mm-hmm. So they really took a chance and I contacted them. I said, look, you know, I'd love to interview one of your drivers. And that was sort of how it started.
Oh, wow. So who was it?
Yeah. And where was it published?
Yeah, it was,
Everything now.
Right. So the first driver was Nico Hülkenberg.
Again. Oh, we love Hulk.
I mean, what a guy. Just such a nice guy. And it was only last year. I mean, this has all happened quite quickly. So it was during last year that I reached out. We put it together and he was at Haas at that point, obviously, and was starting to get some great results because he'd been out of the sport, he'd lost his seat, and then he'd been a reserve driver and he'd been doing a bit of endurance racing and then he came back in. And as we saw this year, he's just been on this kind of like amazing journey of coming back and achieving better and better results. So it was a great time to chat to him. And I will say there was one awkward moment because, again, I just was so excited to talk and I said, at this point, obviously, he hadn't had a podium yet. Now he has. But at the time, I said, oh, you know, is there anything you'd still like to achieve in the sport? And he's like, well, it's like, you know, a win would be nice. And I was like, okay.
Winning something would be good.
Yeah. But.
Funny. Well, there could have been other things that he wanted to achieve. So it wasn't the biggest faux pas in the world.
How did you interview him, Riley? Was it like on Zoom? Could you see each other?
Yeah, so that one was on Zoom. So he was over, I think, it was between, I want to say, Silverstone and maybe Austria. So kind of midway point through last season. And it was actually, he'd gotten, I think, I want to say fifth place maybe at Silverstone last year, which was amazing, again, for Haas. And then he came back, and then the week after we did the interview, I think he did like fifth or sixth in Austria. You could see that there was something going on. Like he was really starting to really transcend that car, because it wasn't a great car, you know?
No. We'll all be honest there. I just want to pick up on something that you've said actually just before about how Haas were doing so much with a lot less. I feel like this is exactly where people like yourself come in. It's all well and good to interview Lewis Hamilton or Charles Leclerc at Ferrari and, you know, these massive teams and get them coverage and all that sort of stuff. But it's things like interviewing Nico Hülkenberg at Haas that really make the biggest difference, because they don't have as much as what, you know, Mercedes or McLaren or anything like that have. So, and I mean, it's great for you because it's probably a lot easier to interview someone from Haas than it is, you know, Sir Lewis Hamilton.
I think that's such a good point, Mon, and they're so appreciative of it, but it is a two-way street, because from there, once you've got maybe one interview in your portfolio, so that piece on Nico was published in Maxim in print, and then when later on, when I was going over to Singapore for my first race weekend, I had that, and I had a couple other little things that I could give to other teams. And honestly, I was surprised. I went to Singapore and I interviewed Jack, which we'll maybe talk about later, when he was reserve at Alpine. Because it's so small, they said, oh, we've heard about you. I talked to the press people at Haas, and they do all communicate like that, which I was kind of surprised by, because I was like, really? You know, but clearly when they're getting requests, so I will say this to anyone who's a journalist or who's trying to get into doing a bit of like F1 journalism, you never know who's hearing about you or listening from early on, because I guess they are protective as well. When you're coming into their paddock and their workspace, they do vet amongst each other about, okay, who's a good person to sit down with our driver.
Yeah, who's going to do the right thing? Who's going to ask, you know, sensible questions, and who's not out just to make a clickbait headline? And you know what I mean? Yeah, totally.
Who's easy to get along with? Who's, you know, who looks like they know about the sport? That all comes into play. It's the same in travel journalism too, right?
Totally.
If you're an absolute not nice person,
or a total diva on press trips and stuff,
they know, and they will not invite you along again. So it's interesting to hear that happened so early on, like
I know,
with your career,
and that the other teams had heard about you as well. Yeah. I'm surprised. I actually thought that the other teams would be a bit more protective of, then more open to sharing information. Sorry, I didn't say that very well.
Yeah. Again, another surprise, actually, I think, especially with the press officers, is you do often see them socializing in the paddock. Like they're all very, I don't know what it is about Formula One, but they do seem to hang out and they jump around teams. So there's people remember from last year who were in the press team at one team and they've now moved over. And for example, the people at Sauber, obviously they're becoming Audi, and there is that kind of musical chairs thing. And that seems to be just as prevalent with the pit crew and the media and all the support stuff as it is with the seats.
Yeah. I guess once you're in the sport, that's what you do. There's only 10 teams that you can remain in Formula One with. So you're going to see a lot of the same people, you know, moving
around. The World Rally Championship was exactly the same as far as the mechanics and the marketing and PR people. But with Nico Hülkenberg's interview, how long were you given? Were you given a set time?
I definitely submitted questions. They didn't have any kind of copy approval, which is quite common now, especially when you're interviewing public figures. A lot of people want that. I don't really do that on principle, but I did give them just a general overview of what I'd like to talk about. We talked for maybe 15 minutes. So, you know, again, I thought pretty generous considering at that time, I mean, I hadn't written anything about Formula One, frankly. that they were very, yeah, they were very generous. And I remember at the time thinking, oh, I was surprised that I got the interview, to be honest.
Were you starstruck at all? You know, were you nervous?
He's such a nice guy. I think he's been around the sport for so long, and he kind of made a joke. I think at the end he said something like, make me famous. You know what I mean? Like, he's just, he was just having fun. You know, when you do,
yeah.
And I know for you guys as well, when you're talking to someone and you can tell that they just sort of want to get through it and it's maybe not their favorite thing doing press and interviewing. Mm-hmm. But for Nico, I think at this point in his career, he's just enjoying it, really like lapping taking it all in. Yeah.
It's funny you say that actually, because some of the worst interviews are the ones where you just can't, that like they're taking it too much like a business or like a business transaction, and you just, you can tell that they've prepared their answers or that they're being really cagey and the conversation doesn't flow. And that's when, yeah, the interviews A are terrible and B, the stories might not be as great because you don't have those, you know, those golden little moments in between the hard-hitting questions where they say something like, oh, make me famous, that, yeah, you know, then become such great little quips for your story.
Yeah, it could even be, yeah, a headline, couldn't it?
So, yeah, right.
Nico Hülkenberg asked me to make him famous.
Oh, bless. Mm.
Do you have one question that you always ask people when you're interviewing them, Riley?
I always think of it in terms of, like, what do the readers want to hear or what hasn't been asked before? There's that side of it. But then there's always the obvious ones, right? I always ask them about how they think the car, like all the kind of technical sort of straightforward things. But I also like to get in there. This is my favorite actually, is how do you unwind? Like, how do you step away from this incredibly stressful, constant travel, constantly being away from home, away from your family? Like, how do you unwind and how do you get back to real life? And I've always found that that seems to be one where they let their guard down a bit. And, you know, like Hülkenberg, he's like, well, I just like to watch movies with my family and order in food. You know, it's just those things. And you think, okay, they are a normal person. They're amazing athletes, but they're also just normal people.
I love that it does drop their guard because it's a really personal question. You're not asking the questions about, you know, how the car's doing and all those things, you know, they've prepped for, and it's not business. It's literally you just being like, yeah, how do you, yeah, it's like you're talking to a mate. I love that.
Yeah. I love that too. You told us before we jumped on the pod that you went to Singapore last year and that was your first Grand Prix experience. What did you do in Singapore? Were you there as a journalist? Did you go as a fan? How did it all come about?
Well, it kind of evolved again because I'd wanted to go, and I'm sure for a lot of Aussies, if you don't go to Melbourne, it seems like Singapore is kind of the de facto second race because it's kind of close for us. Yeah. So I'd had in my head for most of last year, I'm like, you know, I would really like to go over and just as a fan and sit there and just take it all in as a Grand Prix. It's pretty amazing, you know, at nighttime and in the city street track. And then, honestly, like in the weeks leading up, I, you know, tickets, and it's hard to find tickets, and I'm like, I don't know. And then I got lucky that I was able to get a media pass to be in the paddock, and I thought, all right, I'm going to really try and turn this into a bit of a work trip. I work for a news outlet 9 to 5, and then I also do most of my motorsport stuff kind of freelance. So I thought, okay, like I'm going to reach out to all the outlets that I write for, and I'm going to say I'm going to be there. And I'm going to try and really lean into it, I guess. And that's how it happened. And so, yeah, I got to spend the race weekend starting with the media day and then, you know, practice and everything in the paddock. And it was pretty awesome. It was kind of like Madame Tussauds where you're like, oh, like, you know, there's Lewis Hamilton and there's, you know, Jackie Stewart and all these like kind of like, right?
Yeah, but, yeah, I completely understand because I haven't been lucky enough to be in the paddock, but I've been in the paddock club in Bahrain and their paddock club sits above the paddock, so you can see everyone walking to their respective team, you know, spots. And I'd literally be walking along from the toilet and I'd be like, oh, there's Jack Doohan. Oh, look, there's Gunter Steiner. There's Matteo Bonato. The ladies that I was with were like, how are you doing this? I'm like, how can you not see them? But it's so surreal because you see them on the TV, when you're watching the race weekends, when you're watching Formula One, and then to see them standing there in person, you're like, it does feel like Madame Tussauds. It's like, is that there?
That was the same when I was in Melbourne in the Red Bull Energy Station. They had like a garden, fenced off kind of garden out the front before walking into the hospitality, and then the track was on the other side in between track action. you know, we were sitting in this garden bit just because it was pretty noisy in there, you know, music's pumping. It's like, it's great fun, but just to have a bit of a respite. And I was there with Belinda Jackson, a fellow travel writer who actually invited me along. I could not even finish a sentence with her because we'd start chatting and I'd be like, this crusty, and I'd be jumping out of my seat.
And it's funny when you're with people that don't recognize them because they're like, what, who, where?
You're in the paddock in Singapore working as a journalist. You obviously went to the pre-race press conference. And then, you know, did you have any interviews lined up or what did the rest of your weekend look like?
I really can't say enough about how great they are in terms of they really do give, I mean, the Grand Prix organizers, especially in Singapore, they really do like set it up really nicely. So there's time for print journalists to go to hospitality for this team or that team, and you can sit down with the drivers in a group setting for 10 minutes and put your phone down and ask a question, that kind of thing. And then also for that weekend, I had a couple one-on-ones, which I'd arranged with the teams directly. So that was really great. So that weekend I did Joe Guan Yu, who was at Sauber at the time, and then Jack at Alpine. So he'd already got the seat. We knew that he'd have the seat for this year, but at that time he was still the reserve. He was just sort of there in waiting, I guess.
And how was it meeting Jack?
Yeah, exactly. What did he say? Tell us everything.
Yeah, I mean, he's just such a nice guy in terms of you can just tell with his dad, right? Like his dad has sort of been there alongside him this whole journey. And his dad was literally there. Like he was in the hospitality and I was like, oh, there's Mick Doohan. So, you know, you can tell that his dad is definitely given him a lot in terms of managing this whole experience, because for someone who was a reserve driver who was preparing to take a full-time race seat in Formula One, he was so in the zone, like just sort of articulate and have really thoughtful thoughts about what it would be like to be racing full-time. And you could tell that, you know, he had been so well prepared by, I'm assuming a lot of it was his dad. And that was, again, it just made it so much harder, I think, this year, seeing how things went. It was so sad to think that,
let's
you know, in such,
talk.
I know, but yeah, I mean, it was hard to think to go from this time last year in Singapore, where he had so much sort of excitement for the year ahead, to know that it ended up this way is a bit, bittersweet, I guess.
I feel for him because as you've said, you met him and said he's a really nice guy, but he does come across as a very soft, not in a bad way that he can't handle himself under the pressure and all that sort of stuff, but he seems like a softly spoken, genuine, lovely guy. And it'd crush anyone to have what happened to him happen. But in particular, he's Aussie.
Yeah.
It does hurt.
For anyone catching up and listening to this down the track, Jack Doohan had 5 races with Alpine at the start of this season, 2025, and then was brutally axed from the team. He actually had 1 race at the end of 2024 as well and replaced with Franco Colapinto, the Argentinian.
I always love listening to Jack Doohan because when he was reserve for Alpine, he was doing a lot of commentary. He was always invited in to do some pre-post-race show stuff, and he just seems to know so much. And I always thought watching him that it would be sad to see him go from those pre and post race shows because he was really so wonderful to listen to. Fingers crossed if he doesn't get a race seat again, that he does step back into those roles because he was really good.
What do you think, Riley? I mean, you've spoken to him. Have you spoken to him since? Have you reached out?
No, I was there again in the paddock for Melbourne this year. So I saw him in the setting of he's doing his post-qualifying presses, you know, when they stand there and it's like a media kind of pit. And I remember he was there and obviously Melbourne was a hard race for him because of the rain and then literally the car went out from under him. So I haven't spoken to him, but what really stuck with me from Melbourne this year was he was on all the posters. There's the magazine, you know, the kind of record, I guess, that they give out for each race. Like, he's on the cover. Like, I think it was him and Oscar and maybe Lewis, and that was the cover. So to go from being literally the de facto face of this Grand Prix to lose your seat is, I mean, heartbreaking.
Oh, yeah. Incredibly.
Absolutely brutal.
Yeah. And the Australian GP and the rest of Australia were so proud. They were so proud of him. They were so proud to have another Aussie on the grid there. It could have been so promising if it weren't for, I mean, I'm speaking for my own myself here and my own opinions. It could have been so promising if it weren't for Flavio Briatore and his grand, I don't know if
it wasn't for money. It was just a
exactly
money. It's all about budget.
I'm going to say to your point, Mon, about Jack's future. I mean, even if he doesn't get a race seat for next year, I think he's got a bright future in motorsport. Like, even if it was Formula E or another category or endurance, you know what I mean? Like, he's such a talent and he could do anything. Like, I think he's a hot property in motorsport, whatever happens at the end of this year. And I think that hopefully this is just the beginning for him. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's hope.
I feel like people forget this about the drivers that lose their seat is they're not bad drivers. Okay. Maybe in the grand scheme of things, if they're the wooden spoon winner of the year, then okay, they're not the best driver in the paddock.
The 20th best driver in the world. That's what they are. Like,
exactly. And people forget that. You know, when Checo got booted because he wasn't bringing the results for Red Bull, everyone was like, oh, you know, he deserves to lose his seat and blah, blah. He's a good driver. It's just that he couldn't wrangle that Red Bull. So, and people forget
good driver.
This, so.
Yeah, no one could wrangle that Red Bull except Max, Super Max.
Exactly. Exactly.
I'm curious what you think, you know, with Checo coming back next year now with Cadillac and obviously Valtteri, everyone loves Valtteri. What an interesting journey from a year ago. You know, they both lost their seats and now they're both coming back.
That's so good. I think Cadillac, we've spoken about this in a previous episode, but I think Cadillac have made a really good choice getting two experienced drivers. You know, with a brand new team, they need drivers that know how to give feedback back to the engineers to help develop the car. They need drivers that they can trust in front of the media. They need drivers that have been there, done that. And they've got two great ones.
The personality that was able to shine through when he was with Kick Sauber and like his ads with Uber and all this sort of stuff. It was hilarious and it was great. And he's had to put a cap on it for this year, coming back in to the Mercedes team, because Mercedes is a little bit more like, tie up my tie.
Bit more conservative.
Exactly. And that's their personality. That's fine. You know, not every brand is going to be fun and flippant and, you know, but he's had to put a cap on that. So now going back to Cadillac, you can see that he's already been allowed to show his personality a little bit more, which I think is fabulous, because that's what, in this era of post Drive to Survive, or all the social media really driving this sport, I think the personality is key, especially for a new brand or a new team coming in.
What do you think, Riley?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Valtteri comes with an inbuilt fan base that will follow him, and also an amazing driver who really, I mean, both him and Checo, if you think about it, they both bring with them like a whole package. It's not like they're just a great driver or they maybe bring sponsorship money. Like they're an entire package. I mean, Checo is one of the most famous people in Central America and brings a huge audience with him. It's not more important than the driving, but it's definitely part of the package. And for Cadillac to, instead of trying to, you know, maybe bring in an American driver, which I'm sure was a consideration, to actually go, hang on, here's two amazing drivers who've been out of the sport for one season. Let's bring them back. I think it was a perfect decision.
So they've made a good choice. Now let's go back to Zhou Guanyu, who you said you interviewed. Mm. Tell us about, did you approach them or did they approach you? And was that in Singapore, did you say? And just tell us a story about interviewing Zhou Guanyu.
Joe was someone, I was lucky enough to interview him, I think, three times all up. So, yeah, the first time was that same race weekend in Singapore. And again, I don't know if people remember, I mean, of course they do, but last year, Sauber was having the worst year ever. I mean, they couldn't get any points. They got points one time last year, and it was Joe right at the end when he got those 4 points in Qatar. So they were having like the season from hell, this terrible car, and it was just very grim. And they knew, both of them knew, at Singapore last year, there was a lot of discussion that they would both lose their seat, which obviously happened because Sauber had already locked in Nico and they were closing in on Bortoleto. So they kind of, it was a really, you know, not a great time for Joe Guan Yu, frankly. But again, you know, such a great guy. I remember the press person for Sauber who set it up, they said he's just the best. So nice. You know what I mean? And not that nice is, you know, that's not everything, but like just such a decent person who has actually had to carry himself through a lot of scrutiny. Like, I think people forget when Joe first joined in 2022, he was the first driver from China to have a full-time seat. I mean, that was a huge moment for the sport. And there was a lot of scrutiny. There was a lot of cynicism that was that motivated by, you know, possibly his ability to bring in money from sponsors and to open up the sport in his country. And I think that was something on his mind. Like, definitely when I spoke to him that first time in Singapore, he was... It's crazy to think, you know, he was 24 or 25 and we were already talking about, well, if this is it, you know, this might be the end. I mean, it's a weird kind of situation to be in. But since then, later on in the year, at the very end, I was in Qatar and again, I got the chance to interview him again and he was kind of, you know, I don't know, like he just sort of had this sense of that it wasn't over for him. And ultimately it wasn't because he really salvaged it and he's now the reserve at Ferrari and he could possibly pick up a race seat again. He was definitely someone that was under a lot of pressure, certainly, and did not show it and he got those 4 points for Sauber in Qatar. Yeah, what a way to salvage a pretty tough situation.
It's awful then to have all this speculation from the outside about why you've got the seat because you're not a good driver. And like, so for him to hold himself the way that he did.
Yeah. I wonder what his journey was like. I wonder what his journey was like getting into Formula One. Did you talk to him about from China into Formula One?
Yes, we did talk about that. He had a fondness for Formula One, obviously. In karting, he moved to the UK. His family, they moved from China to the UK when he was, I believe, 11 or 12, like very young.
The whole family moved.
Yeah.
Like for karting for him or for other reasons. That's such a big move, isn't it, for a family?
Yeah. And you can even, with Liam Lawson, he often talks about the family sacrifice. That was Joe's, was a very similar situation for Joe. His family, they put all their eggs in one basket in the sense that they completely backed him. They moved over to the UK. I mean, that would have been very difficult, even from a language point of view. It would have been a huge cultural shift to go from living in China to living in, you know, Milton Keynes or somewhere. You know what I mean? Like, so yeah, he did. He definitely had that family support. And another thing that he talked about was he'd been to the very first Grand Prix in China, which was in Shanghai, I want to say in maybe 2004, 2005. So he was like a little kid and he went to that race and 20 years later, he was able to race in that race in Shanghai. And he said that was the proudest moment to date.
Oh, yeah. Would have been. Wow. That's awesome, isn't it?
Bless. It's kind of, it's like a full circle moment, isn't it? Like He's been through so much. They've worked so hard. They've moved the entire family over and now people are cheering his name in Shanghai. Like, that's so cool.
I wanted to ask you, Riley, you've talked a little bit about how you got your first story, but what tips have you got for any listeners out there that want to break into Formula One journalism? What advice would you give them?
Certainly, I think it's important to back yourself. I mean, honestly, you kind of have to start somewhere. I would say with motorsport, even if you've never written about motorsport before, but you want to write about Formula One, I think sometimes starting at a different category. So like GT racing, for example, in Australia, that is held here throughout, you know, Sydney, Melbourne, it's all around the country. The GT World Challenge, for example, that's a very similar style series in many ways to Formula One. There's teams and there's all the same moving parts, but there's a lot more opportunities. If you're a young journalist and you want to go talk to racing car drivers and get a bit of experience, that would be a great place to start. Something like that. Look at the local categories, build up your portfolio a bit, and then reach out to Formula One. That would be my recommendation because I think that way you do get more opportunities just to write and talk to people because it is, you know, it's a muscle. Mm. Like you need to just do it and do it and do it. And I think if you can do that at your local racetrack for whatever series it is, or, you know, could be motorcycles, it could be anything. Like, there is a lot of overlap in terms of later on, you can take that and show that to a Formula One team and say, this is what I write about, this is where I've been published. And I think that that's a good pathway.
It's the same in the travel industry, right? You see all the time, people are like, oh, but I've never written travel. I really want to get into travel writing. I've only ever written about beauty and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, that's still a portfolio, right? Okay, so it's not exactly the same thing. Just like writing about the GTs or like Rally Australia or something isn't exactly the same thing as Formula One. But when editors are looking at your portfolio, they're looking at whether you can write and find a good story and, you know, craft a beautiful piece. They're not necessarily going, okay, they've written about Formula One before. Great. Sure, if you've got the exact experience, it's probably going to be a little bit easier down the track. But, you know, everyone has to start somewhere.
I'd also add to that that, you know, you've got to find a home for these stories, right? So you need to pitch the stories to some publications that are going to put it out there. And with the local series, the local papers are your obvious first choice, or actually even, you know, the circuits or the series or a team. You could offer to write blog posts for a team. And you could, things like that. It's all well and good to say that try and start with a local series, but you need to have your words published somewhere.
In terms of places to publish it, I know people that have, instead of relying on that traditional pathway of journalism and writing for a website and publishing that way, they're kind of building up their own thing on TikTok or social media as well and having their own community. Because I've noticed that Formula One has moved a little bit more slowly than other sports in terms of embracing influencers and content creators. But I do think that, again, local series are really receptive to that. If you've got a TikTok that you run or a social media account where you talk about motorsport, they're very happy to have you there if they know you're going to cover it and do it. Ideally, you know, if you're a journalist, obviously it's great to write for a newspaper or a website. But if you're, you know, a little bit more of a content creator than just a journalist, definitely there's an overlap there. I can see that it's coming together a bit.
You can't deny the power of social media at the moment, even for us as journalists. So much of our job becomes about, oh, can you get some snippets for Instagram stories? Or, you know, can you make a reel while you're there?
Coming up is Baku. We've got Baku next week. I'm going to ask for some predictions. 1, 2, 3 on the podium.
Okay. I'm going to say Oscar's going to come back with a vengeance after the last race, which we shall not talk about because I will not stop talking about it.
Have you seen all the memes? Oh, the McLaren memes are killing me. They're so good at the moment.
Oh, my God. And all the comment. And yeah, I did see a comment from Jacques Villeneuve and he said, I feel like McLaren are favouring a particular champion called Norris. And I was like, well, yes. So I'm going to say that Oscar's going to come back with a vengeance. And then I'm just going to throw in a wild card there and say Russell and Verstappen. They're going to be my wild cards because...
like that.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Thank you. Thank you. Also because I just want to see the world championship open up even more.
All right, Riley, you're 1, 2, 3 for Baku.
Hey, Baku, I'm definitely seeing some papaya. I'd say I'm going to go Piastri and then maybe a Verstappen. I'd say like maybe Piastri, Verstappen. Mm-hmm. But again, just a wild card. You know what I'm loving? I'm loving these rookies that are getting their first podiums. We saw Isaac Hadjar get that podium in the Netherlands. I would love to see even a Bortoleto get a podium. Yeah, so I'm going to say wildest wildcard, third place, Bortoleto.
Oh, my cousin, 1T, not 2. Yes, let's go. Love that prediction.
And how good would that be? Because to see Verstappen come back like he did last week, hats off to him. What a brilliant drive. Brilliant to see him so excited. Yeah. So yes, let's say Verstappen's going to be up there. Hell yes to having a kick sauber up there with Bortoleto in it. Yes. Sorry, very excited about your predictions. Die, your predictions.
All right. I think Oscar's going to just come out punching. So Oscar for top step. In second, I think Max he's got some momentum at the moment. So I'm going to say Max. And I, being a street circuit, I'm going to put Charles Leclerc in third.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah, nice.
The final three, Riley. So awesome. These are the three questions we ask all of our guests when they come on the podcast. So, Riley, If you could have a holiday to any Formula One destination, whether it's on the calendar or has been on the calendar in the past, where would you choose to go for a holiday, race weekend or not race weekend?
I would say Brazil. I'd love to go to Brazil for the Grand Prix and just the ambiance there. And I did, again, name dropping, I did speak to Gabriel Bortoleto at the start of the year, and he said that he feels that Australia and Brazil, there's a kind of synergy there. There's a vibe. So I'd love to see what Brazil's like. I've never been.
Yeah, I've been twice. It's awesome. I went to the FIFA World Cup in Brazil, which was
amazing.
Oh, passionate fans, right?
And you're right. There is a real kind of synergy between Australians and Brazilians in, you know, just the whole beach, coastal, you know, lifestyle. Laid back nature. So Brazil, interesting. And if you could holiday with any Formula One driver, dead or alive, who would you choose to go on a holiday with and why?
Ooh, okay. With this one, I'm going to go James Hunt.
Party boy.
Yeah, I mean, like,
brilliant.
Because I love that era. I love that it was so rock and roll back then. Like, I love that kind of energy. Yeah.
That's so cool. I love that because no one's ever said James Hunt. It would be a fun holiday, I reckon.
Actually, we've had a couple of people on YouTube comment James Hunt. So, yeah, but no guest on the podcast has said James Hunt. Oh, man, like, I'm already feeling hungover just the thought of that.
I mean, it would be memorable.
Oh, yeah. You'd have loads of stories. Loads of stories to tell.
All right. And our final question is, if you could cook any dish from any cuisine from any of the countries that the Formula One goes to or Formula One races in, what would you choose and why?
I would choose maybe something Japanese. I mean, I love Japanese food and the Japanese Grand Prix, again, another dream destination. So I'd definitely say maybe like a nice sushi platter with really fresh seafood and all of the good, you know, Japanese style things on the side. Something Japanese.
The Japanese Grand Prix and the Singapore Grand Prix are two of my favorite to cook for because I love Asian food. It was honestly such a great weekend to cook for the Japanese Grand Prix. I made an okonomiyaki, the Japanese pancake, and agadashi tofu and bought some mochi for dessert. Like, it was great. Highly recommend.
Great answers to the final three. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me, guys. I'm so excited about this. You know, I love your podcast and I love what you guys are doing.
Thank you.
Thank you. Speaking of, if you guys loved what you listened to, you can leave a comment, you can like, you can rate, you can do all of the above wherever you're listening to us. You can also find us on Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, and TikTok, and you can do the same there. Or you can email us at andawaywego@gmail.com.
Fabulous. And thank you so much, Riley Sullivan. You can find Riley on Instagram at Riley Joseph Sullivan. And we'll put a link in the show notes. Thanks so much for jumping on the podcast, Riley. It's been so lovely chatting with you. And thank you, everybody, for having us in your ears. Until next week and until lights out.
It's lights out. Away we go!
And Away We Go podcast is produced by Diane Bortoletto and Monique Ciccato. Let's do it.